I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week are teenage consumers. Yes, the classic sitcom premise of the high school students going to the mall, spending money, sitting in the food court. That is a classic stereotype of young people, especially through the middle of the 20th century. As adolescents became longer, young people were waiting to get into the workforce later and later. And this idea of the teenager really starts to emerge as a powerful economic force in the post-Second World War period. And companies had to respond to this emerging consumer market in a way that was very different from earlier eras. And that transition, that effort to attract this young market, is the subject of a new book by Catherine Rollwagon entitled The Scramble for the Teenage Dollar, Creating the Youth Market in Mid-Century Canada. And in this book, Catherine goes through the history of Eaton's, the largest department store of the mid-century period in Canada, using material from its archives, its mail order catalogs, and other consumer magazines. She traces how the creation of the Canadian teenager was fostered through things like back to school specials, beauty contests, fashion shows, fads, specialty shops, and how Eaton sought to bring teenagers into the store, how they, through marketing efforts, attracting them to their products in an effort really to create lifelong consumers, right? The idea of the big department store, from cradle to grave, you are a loyal customer. And Eaton's was trying to do that with teenagers through the mid-20th century period. This is a really wonderful book. I've known Catherine since we were both in graduate school at the University of Ottawa. I've heard her talk on this topic before, and I was very excited when this book came out earlier this year. A hardcover came out in the spring. We do have a paperback release date of February the 1st, 2026, which is very exciting. So I was thrilled to have the opportunity to talk with Catherine. Really enjoyed the chat. I think you will as well. So let's get right to my discussion with Catherine Rollwagon. All right. And Catherine Rollwagon joins me now. Catherine, how are you today?
I'm very well, Sean. How are you?
Doing very well. Excited to talk to you about The Scramble for the Teenage Dollar, Creating the Youth Market in Mid-Century Canada. So to get into this, I'm curious about the idea of the teenager in the sense that, as far as I know, people have been between the ages of 13 and 19 forever, right? That age range is not a new creation, but you talk about it in the context of the 1950s and the creation of the teenager. So just societally, what is happening at the time that allows for this construct of the teenage years as we still kind of know it today?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, Sean. And it's true that in some ways, people have always been teenagers, or they have always had that experience of passing through the teenage years. And I think more importantly, even they've had the experience of having certain kind of transitional moments or experiences that mark our growing out of childhood and into adult responsibilities. And that's been the case, for a very long time. Equally true that adults have complained about said teenagers since time immemorial. What attracted me to this question in the middle decades of the 20th century is the way that many things for young people were changing at this time. We can think about one of the things that I look at is school attendance or school enrollment and school attendance and graduation. So for how long are young people staying in school, and how does that experience increasingly define their identity? And this obviously isn't something that just I've looked at. I think about that great book, How Schools Work, that Gidney and Millar wrote. And thinking about, and also Cynthia Camaccio's work, The Dominion of Youth, right? Thinking about how youth culture was connected to education. But I think what is interesting about the 1940s and the 1950s that the marketing and retailers were picking up on was, first of all, during the war, in the absence of a lot of young people away fighting in Europe, teenagers kind of take on an outsized importance, right? More of them are working, more of them are kind of visible in our everyday life than they were beforehand. And then after the war, the way that a lot of the social security programs that started to emerge encouraged society to think differently about childhood in important ways. So I think in a lot of ways, retailers were, they were reacting to what they saw on the ground, but they were also in a lot of ways shaping what they thought the teenager should be.
And is this going on because of economic factors? Like, is it, are people staying in school for longer because, as you know, industrialization continues and the economic structure changes? Like, because I'm thinking of like First World War, the kids who died, and I'll say kids deliberately, like the 15, 16, 7-year-old kids who die in the war, if you go back and look at their personnel files, a lot of them have professions written down, like they're miners or they're working in factories or whatever. Whereas in the 50s, you seem to have more people going through and completing high school. Is that the product of the economic changes that we're seeing that allows young people to like be young or go through adolescence in a way that wasn't maybe possible in an earlier economic era?
I think that is part of it. I mean, when we look at my parents' generation, when we look at the baby boomers, and that's a little bit later than the group that I, the focus of this particular book. But I think when we look at them, there's this shift that happens after the war with things like the child allowances and or the, you know, the mother's allowances and unemployment insurance and all of these programs that kind of take some of the pressure off of families, not all the pressure and not off of all the families, but a number of them, so that in it becomes in the kind of calculus of family decision-making, it becomes a better choice, I guess, or more possible for young people to stay in school longer and to see that as benefiting them economically after they graduate than before, during the Depression, for example. Although, I mean, some historians have pointed to the fact that during the Depression, a lot more young people stayed in school because they couldn't get jobs outside of school.
Is there a divide urban-rural on that, where more urban-dwelling young people have those opportunities, whereas in rural sectors, the need to do the work in rural agricultural settings still prevails? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good question. And this is something that I really, well, I don't want to say I struggled with it, but it was a choice I made early on in this project to kind of focus on the overarching narrative or image of an ideal teenager that retailers were trying to push in their advertising. And that means that a lot of the kind of fine grained detail about who young people actually were and what they were doing isn't a part of this analysis. So I think, you know, I do think that the experience of being a teenager in an urban setting and in a rural setting was drastically different at this point. Not to mention, for example, an Indigenous teenager, you know, experiencing residential schools in contrast to a white Protestant teenager in a more urban setting.
So as you describe that, all I can think of in my head is Wally Cleaver. Is right, that idealized teenager. Is that kind of like the vision that you have of this ideal teenager that's being presented out through these marketing campaigns?
Yes, that's he would definitely embody the ideal male teenager that retailers like Eaton's were trying to target in their catalogs, in their in-store promotions.
So you mentioned the war and the emergence of this starting with the war and the circumstances there. I'm curious because the book starts with looking at a presentation of teenagers in Canadian women's magazines. And this is where the book really gets into a lot of the issues that you're talking about. Is that the result of just the demographics of wartime service? More women are on the home front and consuming on the home front, and more of the younger men are gone? Is that sort of a very simplistic way to look at why this emerges in women's magazines first?
I think it emerges in women's magazines in part because it was a large and ready audience. So, you know, in a few instances, you even see, or I found a couple of examples where it seemed like Chatelaine or Mayfair was trying to advertise to teenage boys in their back to school specials or their teenage special issues. And that seemed really odd to me because I wasn't sure, you know, it seemed like that was aimed more at maybe their mothers or their girlfriends rather than themselves. But I think it's partly a product of the fact that by the mid 1930s, Chatelaine, the audience is growing. It's become a very popular magazine, even though it only started in 1929. And the other magazines, the Canadian Home Journal, had a well-established audience, and they were like magazines in the United States as well. There was always this desire to reach different types of female audiences, you know, the young homemaker, but also increasingly in the 1920s and 30s, the young working woman, unmarried working woman. And then we start to see the arrival of the university student or the co-ed as a target. And then increasingly over time, that shifts to the high school student. So this kind of shifting category of the co-ed intrigued me quite a bit. And I know that it seems obvious, you know, teenagers also have their own magazines, Young and Modern, 17. A lot of these magazines started publishing in this period in the late 30s and early 40s. And those are obvious sources for this type of marketing. But I was curious to see what Canadian women's magazines would say, and how much space they would dedicate to this emerging market segment.
And who do you think they're marketing to? Is it to the teenage girls themselves, or is it to their mothers and kind of creating this social pressure of, hey, this is what your family should look like? Who do they think their audience is? And especially in this era where, I mean, my understanding at least is, women tended to be the mother would tended to be the one who held the power of the purse of sorts of the household, as they were the ones who were the primary consumers. So when we're thinking about who is the target audience, even for a teenage product, are we marketing to the parent, to the mother, or are we marketing to the teenage girl?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the answer varied. Sometimes it was both. I think even in the same advertisement, you had, for example, some of the ads for Modest, which is one of the feminine hygiene products, you know, had these wonderful kind of images of a mother and daughter having this heart-to-heart, you know, conversation about their bodies and all this stuff. And that could have appealed certainly to mothers, but also it could potentially appeal to teenage girls. I don't know how many of them wanted to have that type of conversation with their mothers. But even in the early 1940s, you can find advertisements, and I think Kotex is a really good example of this, where they are clearly targeting teenagers or young people living at home, right? Talking about how menstruating might get in the way of helping mom with the chores or, you know, volunteering for war service because mom has to do her part too and blah, blah, blah. So it definitely, they start to do that even in issues of Chatelaine where it's not an explicitly a junior issue or a special issue of the magazine. They are increasingly aiming content at younger women.
Which, I mean, I guess that makes sense. That's always, you know, when you hear about advertising and marketers, they always want the next generation, young folks. That's their target audience is. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, they also kind of set themselves up as being able to help arbitrate some of the disputes that would, you know, we assume naturally occur between mothers and their teenage daughters. So, you know, they're advertising themselves to mothers to say, you can use this magazine to help your teenage daughter develop appropriate fashion sense, and we can help you with that. Yeah.
Right. And are they tapping into ideas like Victorian ideas of womanhood that probably still exist for some older women in the 1950s? Like, do you see it like that sort of those values being talked about or being pushed in these ads?
Some of the advice columns, they tend to lean more towards, and this kind of gets into the kind of popular psychology of the time, but that mothers should not try too hard anyway to push certain values, or not values, but more like practices, you know, around dating or wearing a corset, that's a big one, onto their daughters, and that they should try to recognize that what they would call, you know, proper social development requires young people to follow the lead of their peers and do what their peers are doing. And so you don't want to make your child kind of stand out by forcing them to adhere to kind of old fashioned practices. Yeah. Yeah.
That sounds very like obviously like it's the 40s, 50s, but it sounds very like Cold War-ish, like don't stand out, like you don't want to be like that's very McCarthyist in that. Like,
yeah, no, it is. It's kind of, I think it kind of connects, I think, to, I was shaped quite a bit by Mona Gleason's work on, you know, the post-war psychology of normal, the normal family, and the way that idea gets brought into not just schools and curriculum, but also, you know, popular psychologists that are writing in magazines and newspapers and are trying to help parents navigate the relationships they have with their teenage children.
And are they trying to, because I'm thinking in the context of television and the emergence of television here, are they trying to emulate what is being seen on TV? This is very early days of, you know, sitcoms and pop stars, that kind of stuff. Are they emulating that in the advertisements and the things that they're putting in the magazines?
I haven't seen a lot of 50s television commercials. It's really hard to see them.
It is. They're all like nobody recorded anything. It's the worst thing. Yeah.
It's crazy. What I know about television in the 50s anyway, is it was very much aimed at as broad an audience as possible. So, I mean, there were obviously like children's commercials and there was a bit of differentiation there, but I think a lot of print advertising and magazine copy was still quite distinct.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Like, there's still like TV's new. Not everyone had a TV. Like probably I would have guessed that less than 50% of the population had a TV in the 1950s. Like it's not probably a trend setting media at that point.
Like, it was, I mean, there were children's programs and there were family programs, but as far as I can tell, there weren't a lot of, for example, like when we think of American Bandstand and like all those types of programs, they came along a bit later, right? They're kind of a product of the 60s.
Yeah. So one of the main players in the book is Eaton's, the Eaton's company. For people, like if anyone's listening to this and they're say under 30 years old, they might not know what Eaton's is. Like how powerful and important was Eaton's in the 1950s just as a company?
I mean, I think Eaton's was arguably by the 1950s even, its power was starting to wane. I think Donica Belisle and I, well, we could debate it, but like the 1930s were really the absolute power. It was kind of, you know, the department store of Canada, the largest in the British Empire, it sometimes tried to claim. But even in the 50s, a lot of that cultural power as well as economic power lingered, I think. And of course, Eaton's wasn't the only department store in Canada. The Bay was there as well. In Toronto, you had Simpsons. In other parts of the country, like Vancouver, you had Woodward's, Ogilvy's in Ottawa. There are lots of smaller department stores. And I've seen some evidence that many of them did the same type of thing, right? Eaton's was really powerful in that when it did things, a lot of other companies wanted to emulate the practices that it was doing. And it also was large enough that it did everything in-house. I mean, you can still, if you know someone who's old enough, you can still find, you know, Eaton's appliances, and they made a lot of their own products in the first half of the 20th century, and they sold them. They had this massive catalog mail order aspect to the company so that they reached into a lot of homes. So even if you didn't live near a department store, you could access their products. And even if you didn't get a catalog, as you know, as the story about the hockey sweater shows us, you could just write to them and they would send you something. Yep. So they did have a lot of cultural impact in that way.
And in terms of the catalog and looking at what you've done in the book and looking at the advertisements, how powerful are those advertisements? And I think I grew up in the 90s and remember looking at an Eaton's catalog, and it was just kind of pictures of the product or somebody wearing the product and that. But in the 1950s, like if somebody picked up the Eaton's catalog, what are they looking at and how are they trying to reach the teenage demographic specifically?
What I found interesting is that, so for a lot of this period that I was looking at, the images in the catalog are drawings. They're not photographs. They weren't paying models necessarily. They start to do that with, they'll have a few pages of female, usually women, modeling some of the, you know, kind of more expensive or more luxury items. But for the most part, with children and young people, the images were drawn. And I find that kind of fascinating because it meant that the artists could make choices about how they wanted to depict children, to distinguish them over time. When Eaton's, like a lot of other retailers, started to have a distinct size range for teenagers and a distinct kind of clothing line, they called it Teensters for a number of years, they could make choices about how to illustrate the garments that were available. You know, do you situate the young people coming down a school staircase or in a soda bar, one of them was, you know, after school? Do you put them in high heels or not? How do you do their hair? All of these things can indicate visually to a reader how old this person is. And of course, they're hoping that by doing that, as well as by using, I think they thought it was probably kind of hip language to appeal to younger people, that they would attract more young consumers, whether it was teenagers themselves or their parents, right? Their mothers ordering a dress that they thought would appeal to them.
And how important is that student aspect that you mentioned? Because, you know, a 13-year-old is very different than a 19-year-old, but they're both technically teenagers. So mm-hmm. is the crux of this, because I know it comes up in the book, is the crux of teenagehood being a student? Is that kind of what the company and what the advertisers are thinking about when they think of teenagers, is those who are going to school?
Yes. Yeah, they make a strong connection visually and in the language they use between the teenage identity and being a student, mostly a high school student, although they don't often spell it out. And I think in a lot of cases, they also included kind of early university students, right? They want to draw as broad a definition as they can in some ways. But yeah, this is very kind of different from some of the research we have from the United Kingdom, for example, where a lot of people in their teens who were working and had a lot of disposable income kind of became the first target market for teenager for retailers, pardon me, hoping to, so working class youth were kind of the first teenagers, a lot of British historians have argued. But in Canada, it was very much, they wanted to depict an image of the teenager that was a high school student that had those particular pursuits. And that meant they were they were more likely to be targeting a kind of middle class or upper class young person, right, who was actually staying in school longer.
Is there any way to understand or try to put any conclusion on the success of this? I mean, obviously, teenage culture still exists, so to a certain extent, it was very successful. But for the company itself, say in the case of Eaton's, is there anything that you've seen talk about, hey, this is going great, everyone, let's like keep hammering this home?
In the case of Eaton's, it doesn't exist anymore, and it
didn't do that great.
And arguably that was something that started to happen even in the 1960s and 70s in terms of their losing their market share, the rise of kind of budget department stores or lower price department stores starts to eat away at that. A lot of more kind of specialized boutique stores and the, increasing number of shopping malls that draw people to them. Even if Eaton's is the anchor tenant, there's still a whole bunch more choice just outside the Eaton's store. So I think that's part of it, larger changes in the market. I think that the success of their marketing on a more kind of micro level was that a lot of the people who participated, particularly in the junior councils and the junior executives, like they did manage to sow quite a bit of goodwill through those types of programs. And it was a place where they could find new employees, for example, students who had participated in that program after they graduated, or even as they were university students, they could continue to work at Eaton's. They may end up working there more long-term. So I think it did, in a short term, work as a public relations strategy, kind of thinking about themselves as a store that would cater to Canadians from cradle to grave, and wanting to sow that kind of loyalty and connection early on in people's lives. But yes, I think they were a product of broader trends, yeah. Broader retail trends. And, sure. And this certainly didn't spare them from that. But the team leader, it just continues to get reinvented, right?
It has to, right? Like, the model of the mid-century department store was a product of its time and didn't really exist before and hasn't existed in the past. Arguably, 15, 20 years in the same format. So these things constantly change. And the idea too, which we haven't really gotten into, but the idea that they're creating these councils with youth coming in and inviting them in, that's pretty intense. And I guess today people go on social media to see what young people are talking about. You don't actually have to go talk to them, but was that basically the idea, is like market research and totally, create, as you said, create goodwill?
There was a part of it that was market research. It's essentially their focus groups, right? The Jack Brockie, who was the merchandise display department manager, he said multiple times, like, this is such a great opportunity for us to connect directly with these important customers. They also saw it as a way to build goodwill about Eaton's and it's that kind of more paternalistic, we're all a big family department store ethos. And then they also started to pitch it as an educational opportunity, a window into the business world, especially in the 1950s. And in the face of a little bit of pushback from schools, high schools that were participating. So they start to realize they can get a lot more buy-in if they promote these programs as being an educational enrichment opportunity for young high school boys and girls.
Right, like the start of a co-op or an unpaid internship or, yeah.
Yeah, they actually were paid. They received a small stipend, at least some of them did, to attend meetings at the store on Saturdays. And then some of them would have the opportunity to work part-time as well.
Okay, that's pretty good. I mean, hey, you're already in the store if you get your stipend, and then there you go. You're right.
You're right there. More likely to spend money in the store too after your meeting on Saturday morning.
So, what is the legacy or like the purpose of going back and understanding this as we sit here in 2025? Like for you going through, and I mean, you work at a university, you work with young people all the time, you're still around them. Like, are there any lessons that are learned out of this mid-century era, understanding the youth market and how people were trying to advertise and cater to the youth market? Like, what are the lessons that we can learn from that in the context of 2025?
Well, I think, the type of advertising and the media that students engage with today is so different, right? Like not magazines, not going into a department store, but being on social media and advertising is everywhere. But one of the big things that I wanted, I'm humoring myself if I think that young people other than my students are going to read this, but I do have two teenagers myself, right? And I do kind of want, it would be great if young people thought twice, I guess, about when retailers and advertisers appeal to them and appeal to their agency, for lack of a better word, when they say, look, you're all grown up and you have your own money to spend and you're a consumer and you should decide how you want to spend it, to kind of look beyond that quote unquote empowering message to think about what advertising messages they're actually being given and how that... Yeah, how that's really serving them beyond this kind of, and to think, I guess, that the idea that there is one teenage identity and teenage experience that everyone should have, that seems really, potentially really harmful, sure. Right, to high school students. We all know what high school's like. So I think questioning how young people are represented in the past and today is a healthy thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You want young people to be critical consumers. And then the idea too, like those coming of age high school movies, like you don't want anyone thinking if you don't do that, well, then there's something wrong with you. But that's because, of course, that's not universal. Like, of course it's not. So no, very, very true. Now, before we get out of here, I asked people before we record, like stuff that they might want to talk about. I'll tell you, this is the first time anybody has ever said they want to talk about the acknowledgments. I was very excited. I love looking at the acknowledgments of books, but no one ever says, let's talk about the acknowledgments. So like, who are some of the people that helped you out with this book? And like, why is it important for you to make sure that they are shouted out and get that recognition?
I appreciate the opportunity. Yeah, because this book took a long time to come to its present state. Which is fantastic. But I meant that when I was writing the acknowledgments, it was like a trip down memory lane, which I think is a common experience of people writing acknowledgments. But I just think, I had a number of really interesting kind of unique, maybe not unique, but interesting experiences in the process of this book coming together. And one of them was that two people whose family members were a part of the Eaton's junior executive and council in Montreal reached out to me completely out of the blue and wanted to talk to me about their experiences. This wasn't an oral history project. I mean, I think there's an aspect of it that could be further explored in the future, but and that was really fascinating and wonderful. Like that doesn't happen that often that your office phone rings and there's someone at the other end of the line saying, hey, I read your article and I want to talk to you about this. Mm-hmm. And one of them had a bunch of photographs to share that were his father's and they're in the book. And so, if he hadn't reached out, then these pictures wouldn't wouldn't be there. So I really appreciated that. And I just think archivists and librarians don't get enough of a shout out. And I made a lot of trips to the Archives of Ontario, even went before they moved to York, even. It was that far back.
I missed that downtown location. It was good.
It was very, yeah. I mean, I like the new building, but I think, you know, I got so much help. And Chloe Montpetit at the Archives of Ontario, she helping me track down some of the images that, I mean, I'm here in Nanaimo on Vancouver Island on the edge of nowhere. And so helping out researchers at a distance, I think I really, really appreciated that kind of help. And I just think, I don't know, we are so fortunate in Canada, I think, to have communities of historians that are really supportive. And so I appreciated being able to reflect on that when I was writing the acknowledgements.
Yeah, and I think it's important. And even though, you know, there's one name on the front of the book because you wrote it, but I mean, it takes a lot of people, and there's a lot of contributions and that go into any project like this. So yeah, I think it's great that you shout those folks out for sure. So again, if you want to read the acknowledgments and everything else that's in the book, it is The Scramble for the Teenage Dollar, Creating the Youth Market in Mid-Century Canada. Catherine, if people want to pick up a copy of the book, follow along with some of your other writings, what's the best way for them to do that?
The UBC website, UBC Press website, pardon me, not the UBC website. UBC Press website is selling copies, currently not in paperback yet, unless you pick it up at a conference, but it will be coming out in paperback early in 2026. So that's something to watch for as well. Yeah. And I think... someone asked me what my favorite chapter was.
Ooh, that's a good question.
And
yeah,
it is. And it's hard to pick, you know. But I think people who are interested in Edens and who may remember Edens even would probably be most interested in chapter 3 that looks at how the stores were reorganized to make space for teenagers.
Yeah, that's really interesting. The idea of, yeah, how do you change the physical space to adapt for this new market? Yeah, really very fascinating stuff. The whole book is really great. So definitely want everyone to check it out. There is also, you can buy from the UBC website, there's the PDF EPUB version as well. So you can get that if you'd rather read it that way. But definitely encourage everybody to check it out. And we'll put a link to the UBC Press page in the show notes below if you want to check it out. So again, Catherine, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Sean. It's been fun.
So there you have it, my chat with Catherine Rollwagon. I thank her for her time. Again, the book is The Scramble for the Teenage Dollar, Creating the Youth Market in Mid-Century Canada. As I said at the top, paperback edition. We have a release date for it, February 1st, 2026. And if you order before the end of 2025, there is a sale on the UBC website, a 20% off all books from UBC Press. The show notes down below will be the UBC Press link to the book, and the promo code information is right there when you click on it. So if you're interested in the book, please do check it out prior to the end of 2025 to save a couple of dollars. So with that, let's go right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from NPR, a segment from All Things Considered entitled How Tech Companies Are Catering to Generation Z Teens. And this came out on November 27, 2017. And it is an excerpt of an interview between the hosts of the show, Kelly McEvers and Carl Haller, a partner with IBM's global consumer industry team, about how marketing to these Generation Z or Generation Z folks, how important it is to companies, and in particular with Amazon. The idea of having to capture these people when they're young, trying to capture these people when they're young, same thing that Eaton's was doing back in the mid-20th century. Get them as adolescents, get them as teenagers with the idea that they will be brand loyal to you and they will shop with you for a long time. This interview in particular back in 2017 was from Cyber Monday, which I feel like was a bigger deal in 2017 than it is now. Frankly, I think Black Friday was either, because they waited until those days for sales. Now it's kind of just the whole month of November, but it gets into this process through which Amazon is targeting teenagers, things like Prime memberships. If a parent has one, they can get one for the child as well. Things like that, just efforts to get teenagers on Amazon using it. And again, remember, this is 2017, pre-pandemic, where the shift from brick and mortar to online was already in process, but it was exacerbated there in 2020. There's a stat in the article that 90 cents out of every dollar spent in retail was brick and mortar back in 2017. That number has gone down in the 8 years since. So through this process of shifting to online, the marketing towards youths has become even more important. As Catherine and I were talking about in the episode, this is the target market. You're trying to get these people again so that you can have them for a very, very long time, particularly, especially, well, ideally for these companies for the rest of their lives. So that'll be linked down below. Today's historical headline of the week from NPR, All Things Considered, November 27, 2017, how tech companies are catering to Generation Z teens. And with that, I will say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcast, like, rate, comment, all that good stuff. Helps other people find the show, keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. You can find all of our past episodes there under the podcast tab, plus all the wonderful written material there on the website. Of course, if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, what's old as news at gmail.com. So I will say thanks again so much, everybody, for listening. We'll be back with you again next week for more what's old as news.